Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just had a great time talking with Carl Yamamoto about his brand new book, Vision and Violence, Lama Shang and the Politics of Charisma in 12th Century Tibet. That was published with Brill in 2012. Now, this is a book that's going to be of obvious interest and obvious import to anybody working in Tibetan studies, the history of Tibet, the history or study of Buddhism, or anybody interested in reading about those issues. But in addition to that, it's a book that deals with the kinds of concepts and kinds of practices that go into making the story and the history that Yamamoto's telling that are relevant to many other fields and many other people who may not be primarily interested in Tibetan studies or Buddhist studies may find a lot to learn in this book as a result. Among the different kinds of issues that Yamamoto brings to bear here are issues of how to think about lineage and family in history, issues of genre and how we might think more creatively about what that means and what that looked like in the context of Tibetan history, issues of charisma and sort of how all of these kinds of factors, including others, can be woven together into a story about the integration of a whole from fragments. So at the base, this is a story about, on many, many levels, how a whole is created through fragmentary beginnings, fragments. It's very, very interesting. It's really kind of surprisingly integrated in a very wide range of fields. And as you'll see in the course of the interview, this is in no doubt based, at least in part, on the very unusual and sort of really refreshing and transdisciplinary background of the author. It was a great hour talking with him, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope you enjoy the book as well. Hello, Carl.
Hi.
We're here today at New Books in East Asian Studies to talk with Carl Yamamoto about his book, Vision and Violence, Lama Zhang and the Politics of Charisma in 12th Century Tibet. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Carl, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Carla, and I'm looking forward to it.
Of course. Oh, me too. So, Carl, could you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you into Tibetan studies and Tibetan history?
I was actually a very late starter, and I got into it in ways that most Tibetan studies people don't. Most of the people I know have, you know, they've traveled to Tibet or Nepal or, you know, to the Tibetan areas of India, and they kind of fall in love with Tibetan culture. I actually came from I was originally a philosopher. I have my master's in philosophy from Yale, and just Western philosophy. I didn't really have that much interest in Asian things. And then I left ABD. I left philosophy for a long time. And I started, in the meantime, I became interested in Buddhism. I was living in New York. I started hanging out with like the various Dharma groups and such. And at the same time, I was thinking I should go back and finish my PhD, my ABD. So as I was sort of researching where I might apply, I came to realize I wasn't that interested in pursuing a PhD in philosophy anymore. And so I gradually started to think, well, maybe I can pick Buddhist studies. And that's what I did. So I went to University of Virginia, mainly because they had a very broad, diverse program. They had East Asian Buddhism, they had Indian Buddhism, they had Tibetan Buddhism, and I just went in there cold. They probably don't accept people like that anymore. It's like now you almost have to have your proposal written by the time you apply. But then it was a little bit looser, and so I just kind of knocked around the department, and it became clear to me fairly quickly that the most interesting stuff was going on in Tibetan Buddhism.
That's totally fascinating and really inspiring, actually. And it's, I know, if I'm not mistaken, UVA is also very well known for having a very prestigious and very successful Tibetan language program. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So you started Tibetan language training while you were in graduate school.
Yeah, I had no background at all before that.
That's amazing.
And I've suffered from it. I certainly have. And having started much later, you know, it's been a real struggle.
Well, I can sympathize with that, certainly, as also a late starter into East Asian studies from the sciences. And so.
Oh, yeah.
I can also attest, as someone who's read the book closely, it's excellent. And clearly, it's been a very successful and very fortuitous change of path. So congratulations. And really, it's an inspiring story.
Thanks.
So you opened the book in the preface by posing a question that arguably, or so you kind of associate with beginning your foray into the kinds of issues that ground the book. And it seems like a very simple question, but it's after you kind of think about it, it's not at all a simple question. And this is the question, how did Tibet become Buddhist, right? I think a lot of us and probably a lot of listeners kind of think about Tibet and Buddhism as really being inextricably related. And what the book really does is really question the historicity, or really to question the diachronic and inviolable connection of these two things in a really productive way. So how did Tibet become Buddhist? Can you talk a little bit about how that question shaped this project or whether it brought you into this kind of project at all? What was the role of that kind of question in the way you thought about and shaped what eventually became the book?
Well, actually, that question didn't occur to me till very late in my research. I think I was first interested in Lama Shang because he was sort of a colorful, controversial character. He had an interesting life. He was involved in a lot of different areas of Tibetan Buddhism. So I thought, okay, this looks like a really interesting subject. And I guess I always regarded him as sort of a minor figure. And I think this is how he's been regarded in Tibetan studies for the most part. You know, kind of interesting, colorful, but he was pretty much shunned by the other people in his, or in the Kagyu order. But I guess it was probably even after my dissertation was written, I started to ask this question, how did Tibet become Buddhist? And I find it's really useful to ask, obviously stupid questions. And, you know, I've had experience of being in a class with a lot of specialists, and there's a non-specialist there who asks a really embarrassing question, but it kind of draws things into focus. So I asked myself this embarrassing question because I was starting to see that Lama Shang was not just a colorful figure, an eccentric minor figure, but he was actually crucial to the process by which Tibet became Buddhist. And it also, you know, it kind of struck me in the middle of my work also that Tibet has not always been Buddhist. I mean, it sounds obvious, and any historian will say, yeah, sure. But it really hit home one time. It's like, whoa, imagine as you say, they're so inextricably connected. Imagine a Tibet that's not Buddhist. It's a hard thing to do.
And speaking of seemingly simple issues, so Lama Shang, is that the way you pronounce his name?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm saying, of course, as a Chinese specialist here, I'm looking at that name and thinking, oh, it's Zhang. So, okay, so Lama Shang and the politics of Kurisma in 12th century Tibet.
That's the Hlasa pronunciation. In other parts of Tibet, it might be Zhang. So it's not really standardized pronunciation.
Perfect. So this did begin its life as a dissertation. Can you talk a little bit about that transition from dissertation to book? Were there any major changes or major aspects of the work that you had to either reorder, restructure, or rethink in the move from dissertation to book?
Yeah, I think partly asking stupid questions was one way I was making the transition from dissertation to book, because I realized that as a book... Well, first I had to cut out a lot of junk like literature review and things like that wouldn't interest someone who bought the book necessarily. But I also wanted to make it a much tighter, focused book. And so I started thinking in terms of these broad questions. And then once I had these broad questions that sound really silly, when you make them, you can make it more subtle as you go along, but you still have that broad question that is kind of pulling the thing together. And that's what I was looking for, kind of like a big motif.
So the central figure of the book is Lama Shang. Now I know that it's Shang,
right. Zhang.
And you've mentioned him, and we've mentioned his name. Since he's the main figure of the work, and since many listeners might actually, or many readers of the book might not initially be familiar with him as a figure, can you introduce him for our listeners and say a little bit about who he was and why he's important in Tibetan history?
Well, he's generally known as a founder of one of the branches of the major schools of Tibetan Buddhism. Usually they say now that there are four. I mean, obviously the history is a little more complicated, but the Kagyu, one of the four major orders of Tibetan Buddhism. And traditionally the Kagyu is grouped into what they call the four great and the eight lesser. And the four great schools, one of those four great schools was founded by Lama Shang. So he's ordinarily seen as somebody working within the Kagyu tradition. Probably not that important a person, but there are others who were around at the same time that are better known than him. For instance, a couple of generations back, Gumpopa and Milarepa. So he's in that same lineage, and the first Karmapa. People are now the Karmapa lineage because it still survives. First Karmapa, he was a contemporary of. So he was seen as part of the Kagyu development during that time.
So one of the really interesting things about Lama Shang that comes out early in the book when you're talking about his life and his background is that sort of he's one of the things that we know about him is that his early life was marked by periods of what can be described as cruelty. Actions. This is really striking, and it leads to, or rethinking this leads to a kind of, what seems to be a kind of important transformation. Can you talk about that early cruelty? Not because I think that this ought to mark him as a figure, but because it's so striking in the account of his life that we see here.
Yeah, I don't know how much we can take it at face value or not, really. There's a sort of convention in Tibetan hagiography of, the best known example is Milarepa, of having this sort of narrative trajectory of someone who starts out bad and gets to the Dharma and is able to cleanse himself of the bad karma created and become a major figure. In a lot of ways, Lama Shang's biography echoes that of Milarepa, and he consciously followed Milarepa in a lot of what he did. But so that early thing, the cruelty, he did things like swallowing fish and chopping up the rear end off a fly and putting a flower in and then sending it off flying. And he talks about the sort of the karmic consequences of it, which is like constipation and I don't know. It's very funny. And he's a very colorful writer, which is another thing that makes him interesting, you know. But the transition, it wasn't like a flash of insight that changed his life. It's like he was constantly, first of all, he was known as a magician for the most part, his magical abilities. And he used to engage in sort of questionable practices involving possibly animal sacrifices, because there's talk of bowls of blood and the destruction of enemies. Destruction of enemies is the same sort of sorcery that Milarepa was involved in as well. And he was constantly sort of coming back to the Dharma and then backsliding. So that it's a history of sort of backslides.
Now, this is actually, I'm really glad that you brought up the issue of magic and sorcery, because this is something that, from the perspective of any of us who are writing books about figures and having to rely on sources to reconstruct that biography, and you talk very much about the challenges and the kind of constructiveness of that practice in the book, and I think really helpful ways. But one of the really notable things is that part of his... or part of the kind of image of this figure and the history of this figure is this element of magic and sorcery. And the way you treat it in the book is very interesting, right? I mean, you're sort of, you have a way of weaving together these accounts of magic and sorcery in a way that is not judgmental, at least from the perspective of a reader. Reading these accounts of his practices of magic and sorcery, the reader, at least from my perspective, is not left with a sense of normative judgment by the author writing about this. So this is a very interesting part of the methodology of the work that I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about. What does the term mean here, sort of magic, as it characterizes Lama Zhang's practices or the practices of people he was associated with? And how did you decide to approach the concept the way you did? Because it's not at all a simplistic issue, right? It's not at all the case that the way you approached it is necessarily the only way you could have, right? Although I think it's very effective. So
yeah.
What is magic and how did you decide to approach it in this way?
I guess I approached it in this way because in the Tibetan tradition, magic and Buddhism are not necessarily separate. They're not seen as opposing in some way. A lot of the Buddhism that came over from India and China and Central Asia was mixed liberally with local, like if you want to call it folk culture. There's still, I mean, it's certainly colored the character of the Buddhism that survives in Tibet today. The landscape is populated with spirits, and there are all sorts of rituals that probably are not of Buddhist origin, but they've been incorporated into sort of the Buddhist discourse that are basically sorcery or shamanism, ways of dealing with pesky spirits who are, you know, causing disease and bad luck and things like that. So I think it's really important when you look at Tibetan Buddhism and probably other forms of Buddhism too. I think we've had this sort of abstracted version of Buddhism, which sees it as just kind of a set of ideas or philosophical standpoint, and which ignores the way it's rooted in the local cultures, and it changes, it varies a lot between the different cultures. So I wanted to keep this element of Tibetan, of the Tibetan local color and the way it shaped Buddhism. So Lama Zhang, it's not even clear whether what he's doing is Buddhist or not half of the time. And probably the question doesn't make that much sense to even ask. He was just doing what people did. And one of the things he was good at, and people in Tibet believed in sorcery. They could be Buddhists, but they still believed in people able to, you know, create hailstorms and fend off armies and, you know, these special powers that people had and destroy enemies of your family. You know, the family, the clans were very big and they were always warring with each other. Kind of Hatfield McCoy kinds of things. So I guess I wanted to keep the Buddhism contextualized with all of the other ritual and magical things that you see in Tibet. And of course I wanted to be non-judgmental because I wanted it to be integrated into the Buddhism, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Now, you've raised a few issues that we're going to certainly talk about, I think, later on in the discussion. So issues of clan and family and lineage and what that means in this context and that, mm-hmm. how that's important to your analysis, and also the issue of violence, which is also very important for this study. Mm-hmm. Before we get there, to kind of set the stage a little bit for what comes later, the book uses Lama Zhang as a central figure, not just to explore him and different kind of epistemic and sort of historical aspects of what it means to understand and to do Tibetan history and the history of Buddhism with him as a figure, but it also uses him as a figure to explore a key moment in central Tibetan history. And this mm-hmm. is the medieval Buddhist revival known as the Tibetan Renaissance, or the later spread of the teachings.
Right.
Can you say a little bit about that moment in Tibetan history, especially for listeners who may not be familiar with this period in Tibetan history, or maybe Tibetan history at all?
Yeah, well, the second spread is what it's called in the traditional history books. The first spread was during the time of the Tibetan Empire, where Tibet had a very large and powerful empire that controlled much of Central Asia, that actually at one time captured the Chinese capital of Chang'an and installed their own people for a little while. So Buddhism is often associated, not necessarily very accurately, but it's often associated with the early emperors or the kings of the early empire. And when the empire fell apart, Buddhism sort of went underground, or it became something that was not institutional. It was more at the local level, again, mixing with this sort of local magicians and sorcerers and so forth. But this collapse of the empire and the disappearance of institutional Buddhism was considered a great catastrophe and crisis in Tibet. It's sometimes called the Dark Age, or it's sometimes called the period of fragmentation, or the period of Tibet fallen to pieces. So I'm trying to frame this second spread of Buddhism in terms of the crisis period beforehand, this of a society in political pieces, in religious pieces, in cultural, some of the writings from the time evidence a kind of general malaise, a feeling that we had a golden age, the empire, and it's gone away, and now we've lost our bearings. So the second spread, I became interested in how Tibet, which was lying in pieces, at least in people's minds it was reunited. So I started wondering about things that are sort of social adhesives, the glue that holds things together. And that's when I started to think of things like lineage and the creation of different sectarian groups, the institutionalization of groups. And here, this is when Lama Shang became crucial in my own mind.
And this is really interesting because the theme or the kind of the idea of bringing together a whole out of fragments, it really seems to recur through many, many aspects and many chapters of the book in many ways. And so I think it becomes a kind of trope that we can use to understand not just Lama Shang's life, but also this period of Tibetan history. Okay, so yeah. After this collapse, and there's a period, as you say, of kind of consolidation and revival in several respects, and you mentioned two important aspects of this consolidation and revival early in the book. Both of them have to do with innovation. So you mentioned innovation in social institutions that sort of grew up to support new religious practices, and also innovative approaches to doctrine and practice. Mm-hmm. So Lama Shang really fits into this story as a central agent in the historical Buddhicization of Tibet, right? And an agent, really, of this Renaissance.
Yes, so, he does.
So how does previous scholarship treat him? So before we kind of get into, I think, what we'll talk about for most of this time, which is the particular ways that he and himself as a figure kind of shaped this consolidation, how have previous authors understood him? And I ask this because you mention that he's actually quite a controversial figure in the literature. So who was he, or how would readers who are familiar with the larger literature before coming to your book have been familiar with him, and what would they have understood about him?
Well, there's a number of ways that he's been contextualized. The first encounter I had with him in Western scholarship was as a party to a controversy. It was more or less a doctrinal controversy. He's always been associated with a sort of philosophical meditation system called Mahamudra, which means the Great Seal. And it's complicated, but roughly you can think of the Great Seal as kind of an unstructured meditation practice, which is opposed to sort of the increasingly complex and strenuous tantric practices that were also there. So it's a kind of a scaling back, a return to simplicity. In the process, Lama Shang makes a number of sort of hyperbolic statements about Mahamudra as being the only thing you need to reach realization. Forget about accumulating merit, forget about doing rituals, forget about reading texts. All you need is to realize Mahamudra. Like I said, given the context, these are kind of strategic, hyperbolic generalizations. But a century later, a great lama named Sakya Pandita, who's been extremely influential in Tibet, particularly in the development of a Tibetan scholarly culture, made attacks on a number of proponents of Mahamudra. And it was understood, apparently, that Lama Shang was one of the principal ones. And I think this kind of set the stage for how he was viewed in the West, because people knew about Sakya Pandita before they knew about Lama Shang. And he was highly respected in the West also as one of the founding figures of Tibetan scholasticism. But I think because of that attack, Lama Shang first became known as a sort of a party to this doctrinal controversy, which is actually a little bit ironic because Zhang himself was not at all a scholastic, and he once quipped, I guess it was a quip, I can't tell for sure, that he was exposed to all the basic Buddhist literature and he retained almost none of it. But this is, again, this is his hyperbolic way of, you know, employing a rhetoric for a certain effect. But so he was first seen as a proponent of the more extreme forms of Mahamudra that saw it as what they call the single white remedy, or the, I can't remember the term, the way I translated it, but it's a medical metaphor for the one thing that cures everything and that's all you need. And Mahamudra was seen as that. So I think often he's been contextualized as an adherent of Mahamudra, and is probably one of those who took it to its most extreme point.
Now, as we move into the body of the study from here, there are three major concepts that undergird your story and that you introduce us to early on in the book. And this really shapes the way the rest of the chapters of the book kind of unfold and the mechanics of them. So I want to kind of just take some time to look at them in turn and to ask you to talk about what they mean in the context of your work, and also why or how they've become so important to the way you think about Lama Zhang in the context of 12th century Tibet and in Tibetan history. So the first of these that you mentioned is the idea of hegemony. Mm-hmm. And specifically hegemony, you say, as you're gathering it from the work of Gramsci and others who are articulating developments of Gramsci's work. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, all of this was also late in the process. It was actually the one of the readers, when it was becoming a book, asked for a methodology section. But that's, you know, a lot of the structure came very late, like when I started asking the simple questions. And so the methodology structure, the request for a methodological section made me think in these more general terms about what was sort of what my own theoretical assumptions are that I wasn't saying. And hegemony was one of the most important. I mean, I've been interested in the past when I was a philosopher, when I did, you know, sort of cultural studies things. So I was familiar with it, but I don't think I was aware until I had to actually articulate a methodology of how important that concept was in getting an understanding of how a culture in pieces is kind of knit back together.
So why hegemony? Can you say a little bit before we move on to the other factors about what that means for you, especially for listeners who may not be familiar with Gramsci's work, and why that particular concept is one that you find helpful in thinking about these phenomena?
For me, it's helpful because it's a very subtle and non-reductionist sort of concept. It changed with the way a lot of sort of 20th century Western Marxists thought about their theorizing, took them away from sort of more reductive deterministic approaches, and it emphasized the importance of culture in the achieving of dominance by a particular group. As I mentioned in the book, unfortunately, it's come to, in some circles, to be almost a synonym for just dominance, as if it were just dominance. And so it was seen as kind of a bad thing that the strong did to the weak. But Gramsci's notion of hegemony is much more subtle and complicated. And it's not about sort of heavy-handed dominance, but it's more about... And it also doesn't just apply to the dominant group. He was much more interested in it as it applied to the subordinate group. And in that case, it referred to how the subordinate group sort of marshaled its cultural resources to pull itself together to oppose the dominant group. So, and this is exactly what I saw happening in Tibet. A period of crisis, an attempt to kind of put the culture back together. And I think the concept of hegemony is very well suited to that.
Thank you. That's great. So another concept that is crucial and that you mentioned early on, but it also becomes important at repeated points throughout the book, is the concept of charisma. Mm-hmm. This power to create order. And this is, again, this phenomenon that we've been talking about, so creating order out of fragments. Can you talk about charisma? What does that mean for you, and how is it important for understanding the context that you're writing about?
I think, well, I guess just basically charisma, I think of as sort of the authority that attaches to a figure by virtue of special powers that he or she can exercise, whether they be, you know, religious powers or facility in political negotiation or whatever it is. So certain powers that are seen to be extraordinary and that become the basis for the authority. In the case of the Kagyupa suborder, they've always been a sort of a non-scholastic order, or at least their self-image is a non-scholastic order. There have been a number of great Kagyupa scholastics, but certainly at this time they were considered one of the non-scholastic orders. So the issue of charisma came up because it became clear to me that part of what held the Kagyupa together was not necessarily a set of doctrines, not necessarily a common literature or you know, an intellectual standpoint, but it was really this new role that the Tantric Lama took on. And the Tantric Lama derived his authority from his powers. As Lama Shang had earlier, when he was a magician of questionable ethics, there his power was also a source of authority. So the transition from magician to Tantric Lama, they're still dealing with power. They're still learning to exercise it. And their mastery of power in that sense is the source of their authority. So it's sort of charisma that acts in the absence of a kind of doctrinal undergirding as the adhesive.
Thank you. And in your discussion of charisma and the importance of charisma, you also talk about an importance of what seems to me to be one aspect of this power, and that's the concept of the blessing for understanding Lama Shang and his influence in terms of charisma. Can you talk a little bit about what is a blessing in this context? Because I think it's important to specify, as you do in the book, for listeners, what that means and the fact that it's not what we typically think of colloquially as, you know, if we think of, or for most of us, when we think of blessing, we're not thinking about the kind of thing that Lama Shang is doing here under the name of blessing. So what's a blessing, and how does that fit into this bigger picture about charisma and Lama Shang?
Well, there's a very special concept in Tibetan called Chinlap, which is generally translated as blessing in English, although the term blessing doesn't really cover all of its nuances. But as I was reading all of this material on Lama Shang, there was just this constant message of receiving blessings from the Lama, receiving blessings from the Lama, and its importance as something without which no other religious achievements are possible. Without blessings from the Lama, your meditation won't work. Without blessing from the Lama, you know, your doctrinal ideas will be faulty. And so I started looking a little bit more at this. People have written quite a bit on the idea of blessing. But it's sometimes seen as almost a kind of physical substance or a physical energy that passes from a great figure, from a Buddha or from a great Lama. And it can pass into followers, and it can pass into objects. So when an object is consecrated, it's basically being imbued with the blessings of a great figure like a Lama or a Buddha. And then pilgrims will travel long distances to be in the proximity of it. And you have to be in the proximity of it and to receive the blessing. There are a number of instances of blessing in Lama Shang's life story, where it's almost like something that, like being struck by lightning. He goes into convulsions. His body goes rigid. It's that kind of experience, often connected with his first exposure to one of his root lamas. And this is one of the signs that this is a good relationship, the passing of blessings. But the concept also has a a longer history and a sort of pre-Buddhist meaning, where it was applied to the kings, the great men, the great warriors of the imperial era. And it came to mean something like the power that a king has when he exercises power. And somebody traced it back to maybe even height. But, you know, it's just stature in general, whether it be physical stature or political stature or authority. So this started to sound a lot like charisma to me. And the more you can't just identify the two. It doesn't work, obviously. But I found that it worked strategically in this particular situation to bring together a number of concepts that wouldn't have been together before that. So, blessings have become kind of like charisma. It's that which passes through a tradition. I talked a lot about lineages and the formation of traditions. One of the things that's passed down in a tradition and that sort of keeps a sense of continuity with the past is that the blessings are passed through the lineage. And it's a daily ritual in many Tibetan monasteries, for instance. You begin a ceremony by supplicating the past lamas for blessings. So it's extremely important in this context, I think.
Now, lineage, the issue of lineage comes up and is developed very fully in the chapter on style. So lineage mm-hmm. and style here, which brings us to the third of the three sort of major issues that you bring up early on in the book, and that's the issue of style. In particular, you mention, you talk about the idea of a religious style as inspired, at least in part, by particular aspects of the concept of style as developed by historians of science. And so I think mm-hmm. from the perspective of, you know, transdisciplinary scholarship, that in itself is very interesting. But just to kind of see those motivations across disciplines in the way you're conceptualizing this work. Now, you talk about some of the signature elements of Lama Shang's style, okay, religious style, and we've talked about some of them briefly. So you've mentioned issues of his valuation of experiential knowledge over verbal knowledge. Religious practice would be maybe a second element of his style that prioritized meditation and ritual. You talk also about two other elements of his style that are really interesting, and I've love for you to talk a little bit about one of them in particular. Now, these two elements of his style that remain, that you talk about, are the issues of doctrinal deviation. So he's known for stylistically having an unusual or extreme tolerance, mm-hmm. but also, and not unrelated, a kind of a flair, as you put it, for innovation in his literary language and a mastery of several different genres. Mm-hmm. So it's this... it's this last issue or this last feature of his religious style that I'd love to ask you about because it seems so important for so many elements of the book. Here, the first thing I want to ask you is this issue of genre. Can you talk about the issue of genre as it pertains in this context? So what is it? What are we talking about when we talk about literary genre in this context? And related to that, what kinds of literary genres, once we understand what that means, was Lama Shang looking in?
Well, I guess the issue of genre came up for me in asking the question where new genres come from, because Shang is often seen as one of the innovators, as one of the first autobiographers of the Tibetan literary tradition. And... as I was trying to deal with this issue, I realized that there was a lot of sort of cultural baggage that I was carrying, presuppositions about what an autobiography was, how it was created, how it was circulated, how it was read. And so looking at these presuppositions, I started to ask more general questions about genres and how it is they work. So again, I sort of what actually helped me was sort of dumbing down my questions, and so I asked, where do new genres come from? And my basic answer was sort of, new genres come from old genres. This is like the dumbed down version. It's sort of a rephrasing of Harold Bloom's idea of when he's talking about influence, where he says that poems, like new poems, don't necessarily come from experience. We have this sort of romantic notion of the poet as someone who has these experiences and feelings and coming out of his subjectivity. But Bloom suggests that new poems come from other old poems, the responses to old poems. And so my translation of this was sort of, genres, particularly ones like autobiography, which you just think of as kind of spontaneous expressions of subjectivity, actually are very much closely related to the already existing genres. And this is where I got this idea of genre families that are very closely tied together and that show ties that to me seem more important than the sort of formal features that are picked out to distinguish genres ordinarily.
Can you talk a little bit about what kind of genre family was the autobiography part of? Can you, because it seems like autobiography is a very important example of these genres that he's working in, and it's, you talk quite a bit about this, and it seems pretty super crucial for the kind of work that Lanishan was doing. So can you talk about that in the context of this larger idea of genre families?
Yeah, well, I started with an early classification of Lama Shang's work that usually you find when a collected works is put together, then there are categories into which the works fall. And the category of biography was one category, and everything was thrown into that was... there were no distinctions made between, say, straight biographies or hagiographies and autobiographies. They were just all in there. And there were also sort of lineage accounts put into that same category of biographies. And I started to wonder why things that seemed very different to me were thrown into the same category. And so I was looking at both biographies and autobiographies. And it became clear to me that some biographies have much more relationship to other genres, such as supplications and eulogies, than they do with other things thrown into that catch-all category of biography. Others seem to have a lot more relationship to Lama's instructions to disciples, you know, with a close relationship, giving meditation and ritual instructions. So the way they worked is, in the case of supplications and eulogies, again, this idea of supplicating the past lamas for blessings, very much a part of the everyday ritual life of a Tibetan monastery. And this is a very standard form of the blessings. You usually say a little descriptive phrase about the lama that you're blessing, and then you sort of supplicate the lama for blessings. And it seems like the descriptive part became more and more elaborate until the descriptive part became a sort of biographical sketch of the lama. And I don't know if this is where the biography started, but there's certainly a strong connection between hagiographies and these prayers of supplication. And my speculation was that maybe at a certain point, the descriptive part of these supplication prayers became detached and became a kind of an independent biography of the lama. In the other case, I was talking about autobiography and its connections with another genre, which is sort of ritual and meditative instructions from a lama to his disciples. And I found in some of the language was exactly the same as that in Lama Shang's autobiography. And when I went to the actual ritual instructions, I could see that he was giving instructions to his disciples, and then interspersed with meditation instructions would be little accounts of his life. And so it seemed to me that his autobiography was probably more closely related to these the genre of instructions to disciples, and then the biographies, so the hagiographies, were much more closely related to supplications and eulogies.
That's so interesting. I mean, I you know, we'll move on from this because there's so much else I want to ask you, but I just want to highlight for listeners, this is one of many, many ways that I think the book speaks to so many different kinds of issues that may not on the surface be obvious to somebody looking at the title of the book, but issues that are, I think, of interest and of relevance to people who are not working on Buddhism or Tibetan history at all, but who might be interested in thinking more creatively about these issues of genre, issues of, you know, how do we understand instructions and rules as part of a as part of literary practice. So I think this is one of many cases in the book, and this is one of the things that makes the book so interesting, that of you're developing ideas here that have legs, frankly, that have just, I think, potentially much wider implications than simply the albeit very important case of Lama Shang's life and work here. So moving on to the way you're treating and the way we're understanding Lama Shang as a figure, you mentioned, or we spoke earlier about the issue of charisma and the issue mm-hmm. that you mentioned that his influence in the book is based on charisma, and specifically a kind of charisma of the hermit who shuns seclusion in the mountains and comes down from the mountains to assume the role of Lord of the Teachings. Now, this is a phrase that seems very important, and it's a phrase that listeners may not be familiar with. So, first, can you speak a little bit to this title and this idea of Lord of the Teachings? What is that, and how is that related to the way Lama Shang conceptualizes and develops and approaches the idea of the Lama?
Well, I think Lord of the Teachings may originally have just been an epithet of the Buddha. But in the Tibetan tradition, it came to be a way of characterizing great lamas as well. So there were a number of other contemporary lamas who were called Lord of the Teachings. But it seemed to me, in Lama Shang's case, it was especially important because it was his way of tying together all of the different aspects of his life, the religious, the meditative, the political, the military. It was a way of pulling them all together under one sort of one heading.
Now, you mentioned the military. This is the other thing that I wanted to ask you about this. One of the things that we talked about earlier, and that indeed comes up in the very title of the book, is the issue of violence, and this is associated with that. How ought we understand the role of violence in terms of Lama Shang's reputation and his place in the tradition that he was associated with? In what way is violence important to the story that you're telling?
Well, I guess that issue was one that attracted me to him initially, because the accounts of him, at least in contemporary Western scholarship, saw him as a kind of unhinged psychopath who used sort of tantric justifications to justify what he'd done in terms of military conquests and so forth. That issue, aside from making for a good title, sort of moved a little to the background when I saw that it was much more complicated than that. First of all, it only meant to me, one thing it meant to me, first of all, was that Tibetan Buddhism is part of the real world, and it's not really surprising. If you're put in a position of rulership, then you have to execute military responsibilities. So it naturally came with Lama Shang becoming sort of the principal political figure in the Lhasa area at a certain time. I think maybe too much is made of the violence aspect. If you look at the Dalai Lamas, whom everyone seems to revere, particularly like the fifth Dalai Lama, a lot of violence in there. And it was part of it was just sort of part of his real politic, I guess, if you want to call it. One reason that this issue of violence became interesting was that it was suggested in a lot of ways that there were tantric justifications for the violence, so that it was given kind of a Buddhist polish, but with the implication that it probably wasn't Buddhist at bottom. In Tantra, they have something that you call fierce activities, which are activities that a Buddha can perform, including killing, that a Buddha can perform in order to protect the Dharma. And sometimes these were associated with Lama Shang's violence, that he used that as a justification. When I was looking more closely at the material, I realized that there were actually mentions of these fierce activities in Lama Shang's works and the works of his contemporaries, but they were usually negative. There was a time when his supporters, they were backed into a corner on a battlefield, and his disciples asked him to evoke some fierce activities, and Lama Shang said, "No, we don't do that. We don't operate like that." So that kind of caused dissonance in me, because there were other cases where Lama Shang also said, "No, I don't do these fierce activities." So part of what I was trying to deal with was that dissonance between the accounts that did attribute to him these fierce activities and what I saw in the more primary materials. And it as it turned out, a lot of the talk of fierce tantric activities was much later than Lama Shang's time, like 300-500 years after his time. So it could be part of sort of the Kagyu sort of retrospectively building their own lineage story.
Now, after we move from the beginning of the book through the main body of the book, and there are chapters devoted to a lot of these concepts that we've been talking about very briefly, lineage and style, autobiography, genre, and textual economies, and the idea of Lord of the Teachings, and so on and so forth. One of the crucial arguments of the book, and this is an argument that's actually elaborated in the conclusion, which brings all of this together, is that Lama Shang was an aggressive figure, a military figure, a political figure, who sustained a community through what you call his multidimensional mastery, his ability to gather a wide variety of resources and forge them into a unified whole. Again, we have this fragments into wholes theme. I want to ask you, as we move to the last part of our discussion, if you would, if you're willing to talk a little bit about the three most important aspects of this mastery that you argue for in the book. Space, time, and discourse and symbol. So first, let's talk about space. In what way should we understand Lama Shang as mastering space?
Well, the time that he first came to power was a time of great crisis in Lhasa. There had been factional fighting between religious factions that resulted in the burning down of the two holiest sites in Lhasa, the two holiest Buddhist sites, the two temples, the Ramache and the Jokhang. So it was really a time of crisis. His own root lama was called in to sort of mediate the dispute, and he put Lama Shang in charge at that of first of restoring the temples that were damaged, and then of restoring order to the Lhasa area. Initially, Shang was reluctant to do that. He had originally come to Lhasa to ask his lama if he could go be a wandering mendicant. And instead, he got stuck with taking over the reconstruction of Lhasa. I've forgotten the original question.
Oh no! Just if you could talk a little bit about how he mastered space, and so you do mention as part of this, and he constructed statues, roads, and stupas as a way to establish dominion over the space, the sort of issue of reconstruction, of marking sacred space. You also talk in the book about other aspects of this mastery of space, which include also the concept of sealing territory.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
What is sealing territory, and how does that represent a way that Lama Shang mastered space?
Well, part of what he saw as his role of Lord of the Teachings, another epithet was Protector of Beings, another epithet of the Buddha that was used a lot for Lama Shang. So he saw his role as Lord of the Teachings as sort of creating a safe space within a chaotic area, Lhasa, during this time of the great disorders. Part of what he did was to, in consolidating his rule, was to create a space that was sort of Tselba space. One way he did that was this interesting idea of sealing. There were three kinds of sealing they talked about: sealing roads, sealing hills, and sealing mountains. And the term seal, or chakya in Tibetan, is an enormously important concept that has a lot of different meanings, as important concepts often do. And so for instance, a tantric meditator will do certain rituals to seal the space around him or her when doing a meditation practice, to protect, as kind of protective against bad spirits and demons and so forth. So I think there's a relationship of this this concept of sealing that Lama Shang uses also, that suggests creating a protective space. So this is a way of sort of mastering space. It also, later it came to have different meanings. It came to mean being associated with outlawing hunting within a region. And again, this is just like a small part of the protective role of the Lord of the Teachings. So I think it had a more general meaning in Lama Shang's time. It probably included that, but it also included protecting the people within that space. And so he had, for instance, monks who would accompany travelers, particularly merchants. One of the big threats of the disorders in Lhasa was that it kind of cut Lhasa from the economic networks that were so important to its thriving. And so he protected traders and merchants who were traveling, who were otherwise afraid to go into Lhasa. And so it's this protective function, sort of demarcating a safe space as protector of beings, that I see this spatial, and also there's all of the material culture things you mentioned too, like all of the buildings and so forth. Again, this is a way of kind of marking the landscape as Tselba space.
Now, he didn't only master space, as you argue, he also mastered time. And you talk about his mastery of time in the context of the idea of a lineage. So can you talk about that next for a little bit? How did he master time, and what does that have to do with the idea of a lineage in this case?
Well, what I saw as part of the brokenness, or the fragmentation of Tibet during their dark period, or their period of fragmentation, was the loss of monastic Buddhism, and therefore a loss of connection to the Buddhist past. And a lot of what went on during this Renaissance period was a kind of remaking of those broken ties. And part of this remaking was the reconstruction of lineages, and eventually the consolidation of lineages into larger units like orders. So eventually sort of made Tibet Buddhist was this institutionalization of what had been sort of hermit lineages and into large institutions that sort of became important powers in Tibetan society at that time, and reshaped it completely eventually.
So he mastered time, he mastered space. The third thing that you argue that he mastered is discourse or symbol. So now that we understand a little bit more about how he can be understood as having mastered space and time, can you speak a little bit to this last issue of how did Lama Shang master discourse, or sort of master symbols in this in his larger career?
Yeah, well, this came again when I was in the summing up phase, and I was looking for simple ways of putting together the multitude of interests I had. I mean, my interests were in lineage, my interests were in genre, and I started to see that they were that building up a kind of literature was a way of consolidating symbolic resources. It comes from this idea of hegemony. Hegemony as putting together the cultural resources that will hold a community together. And one book that was especially influential for me in my take on Gramsci's notion of hegemony was that of Laclau and Mouffe and their theorizing, which really talks about it in terms of discourse theory and the way the importance of hegemony as being this way creating symbolic unities where they didn't exist before. And I think that creating new genres, creating a body of literature, a style of writing, creating texts that establish lineages and so forth is another way by which discourse kind of puts together the pieces and relates it both to space and to time.
And one of the really cool things that comes out of this, incidentally, for listeners who might be interested in sort of visual mapping and perhaps something coming from digital humanities even, is that you have a really interesting section earlier in the book where you actually diagram lineage in different ways visually, which I think is a really interesting contribution in itself and also is really helpful in thinking about what's become, I think, a really important aspect of what we might call digital humanities, what we might not, depending on your particular preference, but that is the visualizing relationships and sort of taking relationships as a focus of and an object of study.
Mm-hmm. I think that's always been sort of my temperament to see things that way. I'm always drawing myself pictures. And so when I was thinking of, you know, how Tibet became Buddhist, I was picturing a sort of aerial Google map. I don't think Google Maps existed, but a kind of aerial map that showed, an area, an actual spatial spread of Buddhism. And that helped me to picture a lot of the conceptual relationships that I was talking about. And then lineage also, very dependent on, you know, the method of representing it. And I talked about this string of pearls method of lineage, of representing lineage. And it, you know, as a straight line. And when I looked at the actual relationships, when I was looking at his lineage documents, the documents that told of his lamas and the teachings received from them, it was a welter of relationships. It didn't look anything like a straight line. So I started wondering, well, my first thought, and I've heard other people say this, is, oh, people falsify their history. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized this wasn't history at all. It was constructing a lineage. And from the standpoint of modern history, what did 12th century Tibetans know about 8th century? They didn't, you know, but they had a relationship to their past. And it was through these lineages. And again, lineage is this is a symbolic construction. And which is why it can be a straight line, but it can kind of stand in for that whole array of relationships to the past, as a kind of synecdoche, I guess you would call it, like, where one strand of that complicated past will be a way of sort of consolidating the identity of the group. And it's very important, as the sectarian groups grew larger and started becoming more influential in Tibetan society, that they have this an identity and a sense of relationship to their past, continuity.
And is it the last question I'll ask you before we move to the closing, because I know we've taken a lot of your time, this may not be something that you're interested in or familiar with, but just from what you were saying just now, it makes me feel like you might be interested in this. Is there a discourse right now of this kind of mapping, what we might consider under the term digital humanities, right, in Tibetan studies? Is there any kind of are there people working in this, basically, on these kinds of problems in Tibetan studies? And if so, or if not, do you see this as a potential growth field for Tibetan studies?
I'm not really sure if I see it or not. I guess maybe there's a related development, which is a little more interested in sort of the book history aspect of Tibetan literature, rather than just kind of the great classics sort of standpoint, this which is related to my notion of textual economies, of looking at texts as sort of these material objects that circulate through different spaces that are produced, distributed, consumed, and so forth. So I think there's a broader perspective, and I think I'm not sure how it's related to your question or how it relates to digital humanities representation, but in my mind it does, because it's things I drew pictures of also, and so it helped me to represent it. But I don't think there's that much actual work being done there could be a lot of things going on I don't know anything about, but I basically had to get some biology software to put together these things.
That's fantastic. Okay, well, Carl, there's obviously a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to cover. There's a lot going on. There's a lot more we could have talked about. Is there anything else in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to point out, especially for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book?
Well, I can't think of anything offhand, except that people who haven't had the chance to read the book, it only costs $178. This is Brill. so I don't expect it to see in the windows of Barnes & Noble. Although I PDFs circulate constantly on the internet of Brill books, so I'm waiting for that to show up.
And we do have libraries.
Oh, yes, libraries, yes.
So.
Well, my own library actually asked me if I would buy one copy because it was so expensive. Or if I was ready, if I was willing to donate one of my author copies. And I wasn't. I you know, I had too many people that I owed favors to and that I wanted to have a copy of the book. So this probably says something about the funding of state universities.
Oh. Well, aside from the cost of the book or the availability, and again, listeners can consult your libraries if you're not ready to purchase it. I think it's definitely, clearly, I feel like it's a book worth reading. So now that the book is out, and congratulations, I think it just came out, what's next for you? What are you working on now, and what project is inspiring you at the moment?
Well, I've been caught up a lot since I started working at Towson University in the university affairs, like a lot of teaching service kinds of obligations. So I haven't really had much chance to get back to my own work. But what I did want to do at some point, and I've started working on a little bit, is compile a translation of some of Lama Shang's songs of realization. It's a genre called gur in Tibetan. It's very important. And again, as with the genre of autobiography, gur was just sort of developing during the 12th century at that time. So again, Shang seems to be fairly early in the process. Gur is most frequently associated with Milarepa, and Lama Shang is like 2 degrees later in Milarepa's tradition. So he's very close to Milarepa and very influential in shaping that genre. But my thought is actually I'd like to do a book that's more accessible. And there's a sort of in-between scholarly and popular, well, genre, I guess, in books that are sort of aimed at Dharma practitioners or general public people interested in Buddhism, but also have kind of a solid scholarly understructure. That's kind of what I'd like to do with it and do translations of the songs.
Well, that sounds great. And let's talk after, let's talk again after you've done that, because I'd love to read that book too.
Okay.
Carl, thank you so much for being with us today. It's really been a pleasure, and thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me, Carla. I enjoyed it too.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. As always, thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.